The first day was like really overwhelming.
Excitement?
Can't remember.
It was amazing. I loved it.
A new life was waiting for me, basically.
Mostly frantic.
Anxiety inducing.
It was torturous.
Oh, it was a mess. Like, it was such a disaster.
I haven't even started paying off my student loans.
Don't know if you're going to be able to eat next semester.
You're at the mercy of other people.
Sorry, I'm just so jaded and cynical.
Well, one day you think you can conquer the world, and the other days you're not worth it.
This is Just As It Sounds, featuring academics telling their stories just as they sound.
Welcome to Just As It Sounds. We have recently hit 1,000 plays and it's counting. Thank you so much for following us. We can't wait to share new episodes with you. In today's episode, we will explore the issue of gender-based violence and especially the experiences of grad students/workers. We have talked to Veronica Shepp to help us understand the legal framework to address this issue on campuses, the problems with it, and the alternative solutions. Please note that this episode contains information about sexual assault and/or violence that may be triggering to survivors. Veronica, welcome to the show. We are so happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited.
Okay, so can we maybe get started with you introducing yourself? What are you doing? Where are you from? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, my name is Veronica. I'm currently a fourth year doctoral candidate at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I'm in the Criminology, Law, and Justice Department. And I'm kind of in the midst of writing dissertation proposal. Just sort of generally, my research really centers the experiences of people who are survivors of gender-based violence, who also experience criminalization and or, you know, maybe like precarity due to the labor they perform. Mm-hmm. So for my dissertation, I'm really focusing on the experiences of sex workers accessing and navigating social services, specifically gender-based violence services. But this research area really intersects with sort of Title IX and grad worker labor organizing and experiences of graduate workers and things like that. So, it's been interesting trying to sort of figure out what is my research area, because I do feel like it ends up being sort of broad, but those are the sort of connecting links I see. But I've also been on leadership with my graduate worker union at UIC. I was started off as a departmental steward, moved into the chief steward position for a year, then was organizing chair for a year, and now I'm currently on the bargaining team for our next contract cycle. So I'll be, you know, one of the negotiators for our union. So that's pretty much me.
Yeah. Okay. That all sounds fascinating. So you already mentioned Title IX, and in our previous contact, you mentioned that you are critical of Title IX. So I'm really, you know, curious about that. I want to hear more about that. But before that, because we have listeners from, you know, outside of the United States, I want to ask you to walk us through what is the legal framework to address sexual harassment, especially on campuses in the United States?
Yeah, so in the U.S., Title IX was adopted in the 70s. It was sort of considered, a real feminist win at the time. It was sort of at the height of like the second wave feminist movement. At the time, feminists, I will say predominantly white sort of middle class feminists were really fighting for legal representation, not representation, but legal definitions and sort of like acknowledgement about the issue of gender-based violence. And so Title IX was sort of one of the results of the organizing for legal recognition. And it essentially states that there should be no, you know, discrimination on the basis of gender. So broadly, it was, again, considered like a real feminist win, but I say that I'm, you know, critical because of the way that it's evolved and the way that it works currently. I don't feel like echoes the real sort of intentions behind it in the early early organizing efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people who are on campuses, both undergraduates and graduate students, Title IX is really the apparatus for addressing issues of gender-based violence. If somebody has experienced gender-based violence on a U.S. campus, they have really one option, and that is to go to the Title IX office and report their experience. And additionally, if they disclose this experience to somebody on campus, say if an undergrad tells me about their experience, or if I was to tell, say, my advisor, there's a process called mandatory reporting where this will get pushed into the formal process of investigation and whatnot, regardless of whether I want it or not. So that's sort of how, yeah, there's really kind of like two options for people to access Title IX. They report themselves, or they don't even have to report themselves, but they're case could get pushed through anyway.
What happens once they, you know, do report? Like, how does the process look?
Yeah, so, you know, some of it is dependent on what the person who's experienced the harm wants, but typically it involves interview and investigation. Well, an investigation which includes an interview. There could be also interviews of any witnesses that were present, although it's not typically the case that there are witnesses. But yeah, typically involves interview with both the person who's reported or who has experienced the harm, and also the person who has allegedly perpetrated the harm. And at that point, the Title IX office will, you know, deliberate over the evidence and come to a decision on what to do at that point. And, you know, the result could be so many different things. I mean, it could be, you know, expulsion of, say, a student, if it was a student who was the alleged perpetrator. Or it could be, you know, just accommodations for the person who's experienced harm, or, you know, there's a whole range really of accommodations or results from a Title IX investigation. And it also, you know, there could be no finding of harassment or misconduct, and then really nothing happens for the survivor, the person who's experienced harm.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading a couple of reports, you know, on this issue, and I also know from my own campus, which is SUNY Binghamton, like last year, I believe there has been an Instagram account created by, I believe, anonymous undergrad students who are themselves survivors, and, you know, they start to share their stories of, you know, various kind of sexual abuse and gender-based violence from students, from faculty, from administration, you know, from the residential staff, right? So all of these are telling me that Title IX in its current form is not that effective. Would you agree with that? And if so, why is it not effective?
I would wholeheartedly agree. And I think there's a myriad of reasons why it's not effective. But I think one of the core reasons why it's not effective is because Title IX was implemented in the fashion that we see today to point blank protect the university. It isn't there to help people, to provide, I mean, again, on the surface, that's what it claims, right? But we see just the way that the process actually plays out, the re-traumatization of people who have, you know, reported and gone through the Title IX process, that at the end of the day, it's there to protect the university from liability, which is also why we see that mandatory reporting is a thing, right? It's meant to cast this huge wide net and have these sort of internal, confusing, ambiguous processes that are confusing for survivors to go through, so that the university can, again, you know, make the determination that it needs to in order to protect its brand, its, you know, image. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's a business. The university is a business, and to tarnish the label and the brand of the business is not good for the business. At least that's, you know, that's kind of the way that I see it. And Title IX, you know, again, the goal isn't really to provide people with justice or, you know, or these things that people really need. The goal is to protect itself, which is why Title IX investigates itself. You know, there, it isn't like this outside process where people who are unbiased come in and make these decisions based on the evidence they see. It's the university investigating the university. I don't know how much more biased you can get.
I see. So like what you're saying is like the Title IX being ineffective is not about people who are working there or how they, you know, perform their job, right? It's a systemic element. That it's meant to be ineffective.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm sure, I don't know. I guess, yeah, don't even want to get into, like, individuals because I feel like, yeah, there's probably problematic people. But at the end of the day, like, you fire a Title IX coordinator and it's not going to change the system that's harming people, right? Like, that's a very small step in the wrong direction, in my opinion. I think it's the whole system as it's currently working that's really the problem.
So if you focus on the experience of graduate students in terms of experiencing sexual harassment or gender-based violence, I know that, of course, every survivor's story is unique and shaped by different factors, but what are some of the common characteristics that are specific to their position as PhD students? Or if there's any, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I think number one for grad workers, it really is the fact that we are, I mean, contingent, low-wage workers. That I think is like the unifying factor for why grad workers are often the target of harassment and poor treatment by both, you know, faculty, also admin, and, you know, unfortunately, sometimes other students or other grad workers. I think it's, yeah, the fact that we are so reliant on, we are reliant on the university, we are reliant on good relationships with our advisors and other faculty mentors, where, you know, abuse is likely because, again, we're so reliant on them for financial stability, we're reliant on them for opportunities for publishing, but not only the experience, you know, reliant on current experiences and like current opportunities, but we have to have them to write letters of recommendation for us to even have a chance of getting a job after academia or after our graduate school experience. And so, you know, I think that to me is really the like unifying thing is just being a contingent low wage worker. And we're fundamentally at the bottom of the, you know, academic totem pole, if you will. But yeah, of course, I think there are things that distinguish certain people's experiences over others, like, you know, international workers who are absolutely, you know, even more reliant on the university for employment because accessing employment outside of the university is often not an option because of visa requirements and whatnot. So, you know, I think that it's the power really clusters in different ways. But ultimately, it's us being very low wage workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's such a crucial point that you are making. Do you have or have you read any kind of like reports or is there any kind of studies that is documenting the specifically experiences of graduate workers in terms of like experiencing sexual harassment or gender-based violence?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, there's very few. So much of the focus is on undergrads, which, you know, I think that there should be lots of research for undergraduates, right? But Graduate workers are really a neglected population in terms of really understanding what's happening, understanding the nuance of their experiences. There's a couple of studies that do report prevalence rates. And, you know, those are obviously helpful. And myself and some colleagues have written a paper that's currently under review, talking about specifically the experiences of graduate workers and bridging the labor, the academic labor movement and the gender-based violence movement. So I think there's that conversation is starting to happen, but unfortunately, it's just less of a priority because at the end of the day, you know, research is often reliant on funding. And when people are focused on undergrads because they are the ones who pay tuition, right? They are really the consumers of the university, according to really university standards. It makes sense why the research is really focused on undergrads.
I see. Do you have a sense of whether or not graduate workers like report more frequently or not, you know, when they experience, you know, this sort of violence or when they do want to report or not? Are there any kind of, you know, resources on campuses that are specifically designed for them, right? Because like it's a very complicated case, right? Especially if this abuse or violence is coming from a faculty member or from an administrator, right?
Right. Yeah, you're really getting at that. The barriers are just so high for graduate students and graduate workers to report. You know, I think I'm not recalling research that specifically looks at reporting numbers, but based on my own experience of gathering some data at my university, you know, not very many people report to Title IX themselves. I think because of the things that you illuminate there, that the barriers are just so high. You're fearful of, your department being upset with you. You're fearful of your advisor not having your back once they find out that you've reported, right? I just feel like, yeah, the barriers are so high and we are also fearful of getting a job after this. The notion of it potentially following us through, the academic labor market is already so precarious, let alone if you've also now, reported and caused a stir, right? So I get the sense that the numbers are probably much lower than undergrads. And I also think, you know, we have a lot of fear of the consequences of mandatory reporting. I think trying to get access to informal support, which we know from the literature is probably the most valuable for survivors of gender-based violence and sexual harassment, we can't access informal support. Right? Like going to our advisor and telling them casually about some experience means that automatically triggers a formal report. So, we're really stuck between a rock and a hard place. And in terms of specific services that are available for grad workers, I mean, if grad workers are unionized on your campus, then I think that the union is often the best place to go to get, you know, your options without being fearful of, repercussion and
retaliation
and being fearful that it's going to have to now be reported. That's not the case. And so, you know, I think a grad worker union is a great place. And also any of the confidential resources that are on campus that are for undergrads are also for grad students. So I know that I've, spoken a lot with our confidential resources, you know, that'd be like women's centers. Sometimes they're a little bit more gender neutral, which is great. But those types of services are often available, are completely confidential, or they can at least point you to a confidential resource if they themselves are not. But typically they are. So, you know, there are resources, but at the end of the day, like, you know, the avenues for actually doing something about the situation you're in are very limited, even if you go through these different avenues, right? It's a very difficult situation to be in.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking, like, if you are not reporting and if you cannot, you know, talk about this with anyone, it must be a very isolating experience, right? To go through this by yourself. And I'm like wondering whether it also means that people have a higher tolerance for abuse, right? Like not, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think no one wants to stir the pot, especially somebody who is already in a precarious position, right? Like the people who really have the power to do something about somebody who is making an environment unsafe are often the ones maybe who aren't experiencing it, right? They're like tenure track or already tenured, having been in the department for a long time. Maybe they're the ones perpetrating the violence, right? Or doing the harassing. And there's really no benefit to them to like stir the pot, right? They're already in a position of stability and whatnot. Whereas, you know, graduate workers who are maybe first or second year into a program and they're just trying to get their, you know, bearings and get comfortable, it's incredibly difficult to have to speak up and be the voice of reason in the department when really all you want to do is keep your head down and do your work. And so, yeah, I don't blame people for being fearful and not knowing what to do and just choosing to stay quiet in those situations, because sometimes that can feel the most protective. You know, I really empathize with that. I feel like that's, yeah.
So how does the current tenure system play a role in perpetuating this system or culture of sexual harassment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, tenure, I wish I could say I'm, you know, a complete expert on that. You know, I'm not totally, I'm not there yet in my career. But as far as, you know, I think there's two levels to it. At least I sort of see two levels to it. There is the actual power that people with tenure hold, which is that, you know, being fired or like held accountable is next to impossible. There has to be, and again, I'm not familiar with like all of the like explicit requirements or like legal requirement, any of that, but I know that the threshold to actually hold somebody accountable who is tenured is much higher than maybe somebody like me, who's a grad worker and contingent anyway, right? So there's like the actual power, but then there's also, I think, the perceived power that a person has. And so, you know, again, even though I don't know all the explicits of like the power that that person holds, you know, the thresholds that have to be met in order to hold somebody accountable, there's just the perception of power that they hold, that they virtually hold my future in their hands. And I think that that perception is very, I mean, it has a huge influence on whether or not somebody may report that person or, you know, attempt to have a dialogue with them to hold them accountable, even informally, right? Like, it's that perception of power that I think gets them into a position where they're rarely held accountable, you know, because people are, again, fearful of what they are capable of, fearful of the repercussions for an individual's future. And so, yeah, I think it really, to me, like operates on two levels. Once you hit tenure, there is this like level of protection that a person has, right? And the goal of it is really to allow somebody to explore new and innovative areas of research that they might have been, you know, too nervous to pursue pre-tenure, but now they've gotten tenure so they can kind of do what they want academically, which, you know, that's the great element of it. But there's also this like underbelly of, you know, there's really less accountability that can be placed on them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I want to ask you about, so you mentioned that you're critical of Title IX and you talked about this merely, not merely, but also as a problem of contingent labor and precarity and like competitive job market as like important factors playing into perpetuating this culture, this system of gender-based violence. So like what kind of politics do you envision to fight with this?
Yeah, I, you know, for me, I think the thing that we all have as grad workers that I think is one of the only things we have to be able to wield against Title IX, the university, is our labor. I mean, fundamentally, this is why strikes are effective, particularly grad strikes, is because the university functions on our labor, whether that be teaching the classes, grading the papers, you know, providing mentorship to undergrads, doing research, you know, all of those things are necessary parts of the university. And when we withhold those parts of the university, it ceases to function. And so to me, I see, you know, one of the only clear avenues in terms of actually getting what we want is wielding that labor and the ability to withhold our labor. And so, you know, organizing around these things, really taking up the project of addressing gender-based violence through union organizing and labor contracts, I think is one of the like clear ways that we can get some movement. And so I think there are specific things that do need to be done. I think, you know, eliminating mandatory reporting policies is number one that has to go. It has to be addressed because, you know, they're the reason why even informal support is impossible for grad workers, right? Like, we should be able to tell our advisor or a trusted mentor what's happening with us in order to get some level of support within our departments and our program, especially if we just want to, you know, keep our heads down and keep working. But, you know, accessing that informal support is one of the only ways that we can really do that. I think we also absolutely need to get alternative options for reporting, not going through strictly Title IX. Title IX fundamentally was built also for undergraduates and for students and student-on-student issues. Not to say that it does that particularly well either, because it doesn't, but you know, if it's already failing at what it was built to do, right? It's absolutely failing for grad workers who are reporting other staff members, faculty, et cetera. So seeking some sort of alternative option. And then, you know, through labor contracts, improving grad worker material conditions, because it is the precarity, you know, contingent employment, low wage work that drives these things. If material conditions for grad workers were significantly improved, then I do think this culture of harassment and abuse would start to be addressed. You know, I don't think that's the only thing. You know, thinking about intersections of race and citizenship and all of those things are also things that have to be addressed. But improving at least some of the class-related issues would, I think, significantly help.
I couldn't agree more. How do we make sure that survivors, you know, get a sense of justice, of course, but also feel empowered, you know, after that, after going through that process? You know, like, I'm trying to, I guess, like, transition to a little bit of like Me Too and its, you know, impact to this particular setting. How do you see all of that?
Yeah, it's really hard, I think, trying to envision something that will address all of those things. I do think alternative options for reporting is one way to start, because, you know, it does, you know, if we think about like transformative justice or restorative justice, you know, again, they need to not be like explicitly connected to Title IX, because then I think those processes can be co-opted, right, by the institution. But if we think about like real opportunities for justice and healing, you know, so many people aren't interested in punishing people. Like, I think that that's something that is a real misconception. I don't think the majority of people who report or have something to report who have experienced harm really want the person who's caused harm to be just punished and, you know, whatever. I think what many, many people want is, you know, prevention for it to not happen again. You know, they don't want this person to continue to be able to do what they're doing. So whether that means, you know, putting them, like taking them out of their role and position at the university, right? You know, I think that's like one way. But ultimately, I think it's going to come down to restructuring power at the university. You know, I think thinking about like what we do with individuals and, you know, whatever, how we sanction individual people, again, that's not going to change the system as a whole. I think it's going to come down to, you know, how do we restructure power at the university as a whole? How do we restructure power in departments? So that way, again, there's not that perception of, oh, somebody has all this power and I can't, you know, I can't really do anything to address them because they have all this perceived power, right? And so thinking about how we decentralize power, so that way, number one, this doesn't happen again to other people. And the people who have been harmed would have access then to necessary elements to heal, whether that be, again, accommodations, degree extensions, if, you know, this has caused trauma where they need to take some time to heal, you know, just degree extensions, no questions asked, guarantees around employment and, you know, being able to maintain these sort of like basic things that people need. I just feel like, yeah, meeting people's sort of basic needs and having the like larger goal of decentralizing power are where we get to some of the solutions rather than always thinking about like, what do we do with individuals? I mean, of course, I think, you know, some people are very harmful and it's hard not to sometimes have these like gut reactions, but I think really interrogating like, where do those things come from? Where do those reactions come from? And how do we do better than that? Is, I don't know, what I kind of immediately think of.
Yeah. No, that sounds great, I think. And I was also like reading an article on that. I'm not going to be able to remember the names, but you know, so they were talking about the collective aspect, you know, of this process, especially like with Me Too, you know, disclosing the names of perpetrators. And this also, right, happened in academia as well with like very famous, prestigious professors in Ivy League universities, right? Were disclosed as perpetrators and rapists and abusers, etc. And I think like with Me Too, and that was the argument that the article was making, that we shouldn't miss the collective aspect of this, right? This is not an individual empowerment story that we are going to get in the end, right? An individual sense of justice.
Right.
But like, how do we come together and how to establish those networks of solidarity and care and collective healing from those traumatic incidents together, right? I think that's the real power. And like, I feel like, you know, we should be able to envision strategies and the political line that would aim those kind of, you know, goals, right? Yeah. Rather than prioritizing punishment or...
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the last thing that we want to do is continue to replicate what Title IX is doing, right? And like causing harm, being, you know, this, I mean, yeah, replicating the processes of Title IX is not going to then heal us, even if we're like doing it to ourselves, right? Like it's just not going to be healing. And so, I appreciate you mentioning the, you know, this like focus on empowerment sometimes, while I understand, wanting to feel empowered in the decisions we make and to, you know, but I think focusing on that solely as like the goal can be like very misleading and also doesn't get at like structural elements, right? Like it doesn't matter if I as an individual feel empowered if my empowerment doesn't structurally change anything for number one, I mean, yeah, me to never experience it again. And then also other folks who are, you know, even more marginalized than myself to experience this harm over and over again, right? Like I think focusing on the structural and the collective action and things like that is where we actually see real change.
Okay. Those were all of my questions. Is there anything else you want to add?
I think, you know, as like closing thought, I mean, I know I mentioned that you know, my view is absolutely that union organizing is sort of where we have to go with this, having labor contracts actually address misconduct and harassment. You know, I think that that is a necessity. And I just want to mention, you know, we do have some examples of where this is happening. So if like, who, you know, whoever's listening is, you know, part of a union, is doing union organizing, or is not yet unionized, I just want to really encourage folks to get involved. You know, we can make like real actual changes with, you know, the power that we hold with our labor. I know Harvard grad workers, Georgetown grad workers, you know, have, you know, already been fighting for this. University of Oregon, University of Connecticut, University of California System have all gotten some like expanded definitions of harassment and discrimination, which is really important. So that way we can always look to our contracts for addressing these things. And hopefully, as we continue to organize and be in solidarity amongst ourselves, you know, we can actually start to get wins in terms of, you know, fully eliminating mandatory reporting and actually seeking alternative options for reporting to Title IX. So yeah, I think for me, just get involved. If you're looking for a sign to do some labor organizing, this is your sign. It has been, I mean, talking about empowering, like it has been one of the most gratifying, empowering, meaningful things I've done in my grad career. I just don't know who I would be without it. So, you know, I think if this is something you care about, you can absolutely get wins through labor contracts and labor organizing. And everyone should, you know, join your union.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Veronica. It was great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. So fun.
Thank you for listening. In case you want to check out the article I was mentioning earlier in the episode, it's written by Alison Page and Jacqueline Arce, and it's titled Me Too and the Politics of Collective Healing, Emotional Connection as Contestation. Finally, a big shout out to the survivors group on my campus that I was mentioning earlier. They have an Instagram page called @ShareYourStoryBing, and they are collecting survivor stories from Binghamton University.
Thank you for listening to Just As It Sounds. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any questions or ideas for the show, please email us at contact@justasitsounds@gmail.com.